Right. Hi, I'm Brian Cardell. I'm a developer advocate at Agalia.
And I'm Eric Meyer, also developer advocate at Agalia. And we're going to be talking about web and history and things that happen in the shadows. And we have people to talk with about it.
Yeah, hi. My name is Jeremy Keith. I'm one of the founders of Clear Left, a design agency in Brighton in the UK. And I've been making websites for quite a while.
And I'm Jay Hoffman. I'm director of development at Reactive. And I also have run a newsletter and blog called The History of the Web for about a decade now. And so I thought it would be fun to chat to all of these folks about specifically different APIs and things throughout all of web history, starting with one of maybe the more elusive ones, which is Shadow DOM. So that will be our topic for today. You all ready to talk about Shadow DOM?
I mean, ready as I'll ever be.
Where do you want to start?
I think if we really want to start with Shadow DOM, we kind of have to take it very far back, potentially to the early days of Netscape Navigator and talking through. I mean, there were various attempts at essentially what I think is the primary purpose of Shadow DOM, which is encapsulation. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's starting from an incorrect premise, but certainly there were a lot of attempts at this encapsulation early on, starting in the mid 90s, you know, with things like Java applets. So maybe we can start with just, is that the correct kind of framing for this? Or, you know, what other motivations were there when browsers started to think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's always been this quest for components of some kind, of various levels of isolation from the surrounding document. I mean, going way back, you had frame sets. So not even iframes, but like frames, which in theory are isolated. There was a certain amount of communication between them. You could click a link in one frame and it would open in another frame. But they were effectively standalone HTML documents. And that's probably the first inkling, I think, of that idea that there's a whole page, and within that page, there's these standalone components. But they didn't last. Frames were a bad idea.
Why?
I mean, the accessibility implications, for one, were pretty nasty. And then just usability. As soon as you've got this idea of, like, some of the navigations would take you away from the whole frame set. Some of the navigations would open or have an effect in a different frame than the one you clicked on. Some of the navigations would happen in the frame you're currently in. That then immediately throws up the question, like, okay, then what does the back button do now? How does backwards and forwards work in this world? And the answer was, I think, we have no idea, and let's kill this whole thing.
Oh, but I mean, we do still have iframes, and iframes have kind of the same problem, and they're still popular. But I would like to say that maybe even before Netscape, that you could take this back to, like, Payway with Viola www, that, you know, had something like embeddable frames, but, like, the idea there was also kind of close to what became Java. Like, you had a universal runtime, and you could, like, bundle these things in one another, which the idea there also, I think, had to do with encapsulation. So yeah, I mean, I think it's just natural in programming to want to do some kind of encapsulation, right?
Yeah, it's the same thing that effectively you got with Flash later on, you know, or like you said, Java applets. This, you know, this thing is a standalone thing, but you can also put this thing into the broader context of a web page. And people did use Flash in both ways. Like, sometimes people did have just little bits of Flash within mostly a web page, and sometimes it was, the entire web page is mostly Flash. It kind of allowed for both. And it was interesting, actually. I remember when Flash was, you know, really a big part of the web. And at this point, you know, frames and frame sets were long gone. That was like ancient history. But all of these questions about accessibility and navigation and the backward and forwards button, they all resurfaced again. Like they came back to life. Like, oh, now that I've built my effectively all my navigation within this island of Flash, now the back button doesn't work the way people expect. It's just interesting to see that these usability questions just kept coming back as soon as something stopped being a little island of encapsulated something to being most of the web page, most of the website.
I think what's interesting is that as you had things like Java applets and Flash beginning to develop, you simultaneously had a lot of efforts to standardize something that would be closer to what people actually needed. An example being HTML components, which date back to, I think, the mid to late 90s, and XBL, which I'm sure we will talk about. I'm curious from your all perspective, I mean, is it that because they were not standardized that something like Java applets and Flash could have their day and kind of build and iterate on features that they needed? You know, what were the reasons basically for its success, but then also for its eventual collapse, right? In all of these cycles that you're talking about, Jeremy, like it kind of go up and down.
In my opinion, they absolutely were able to drive innovation, which I hate that word, and it's a much abused word in the web. But the fact that it wasn't, a standardized thing, I'm talking about Flash now, but this could apply to other things as well. When they could just push forward and just launch features and get things out there. And that was, I think, ultimately beneficial for the standards process because developers, users got to try stuff out and say, oh, I like this. Oh, I don't like this. You know, can we keep animation? Can we keep video streaming on the web? Can we keep audio happening on the web? That's good. But in this context of, you know, one company proprietary, inevitably it kind of always ends up eating itself. And it's usually down to business reasons rather than any technical reasons. And sure enough, that's, I think, what happened with Flash. But I also think, Flash was a trailblazer in showing us and showing standards bodies, people want this. People like this. Let's find a way to do this.
Yeah, that's the role that I think preprocessors and frameworks, some frameworks, fill today. A lot of things in CSS came from SAS because people were able to try things out in SAS, and then they have made their way into CSS either quickly or slowly, depends on the thing. And I'm sure there are other things that have been done in SAS that no one has ever asked to be in CSS because six people wanted it and everyone else said, this is terrible.
So there's an interesting observation that I have here. We talked a little bit about, we mentioned Flash, we mentioned Java. I don't know if we want to talk more about Java. I also mentioned, you know, Payway's idea. But like those were a web page, you know, some HTML document that you would then create a portal into a completely different thing, right? Mm-hmm. So you had web stuff, and then you had this other stuff that was embeddable in the web. And then there was both Hot Java and Payway's thing were like, you had the virtual machine, and you had the web browser written in the virtual machine, right? And then within the page, you could have more virtual machine. Do you know what I mean? Like it was, you're building of itself, but the of itself wasn't of the web. It was of whatever that runtime was, right? And I think maybe later on, the closest we came to this was Flex in Flash. Flash came up with its own answer. So there were, at the time, I think, I don't know if we want to get to this yet, but we wound up with like three major competing ideas. There was Zool, XAML, and Flex, and they were all very, very similar in a way.
So I want to hear more about this. Jay, you went spelunking and found out about the kind of origins of a web component.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you know, first of all, just by way of context, Viola WWW, for those that don't know, that was developed in 1982, right? So this is like right alongside what Tim Berners-Lee is doing, essentially, right? So we are talking about going back to the beginning of the web and flashing all the way forward to the end of it, which means there were a lot of stops and starts. And I do think it's going to be worth digging into these terms, Brian, to kind of try to understand them and how they all forked in different directions. If you dig into the drafts, you know, of the W3C and you look through the specifications, you may come across something that's called HTML components, which I don't exactly know when it began, but I know that it was, you know, in a more mature form by the end of 1998. So imagine that this is all happening. There are all these kind of different attempts at encapsulation and components. And, you know, certain people, including Chris Wilson, participated in creating HTML components, which very interesting specification for those that would be interested, because it really does mirror the, at least from a syntax perspective, what we all have now more or less become familiar with is the idea of single file components, where you can have your behaviors and your styles and your, well, styles in a kind of very elementary form, and your markup all in one place. And so I think that it's, you know, there were attempts to try to find a way to address this through standards. And I think the earliest that I could find was this idea of HTML components, which in some ways I think informs what would come next. I'm not sure if anybody ever really got a chance to use HTML components, unfortunately, because I think it really just emerged as a standard. I am sure there are test cases somewhere that we could find at some point, but really no further adoption than that. Maybe specifically because all these other alternatives were starting to take off by the time we get to, let's say, the late 90s, early 2000s.
Had some interesting ideas in it. Like that, the mechanism by which you pointed at the thing you wanted to include, was the way you pointed at this other self-contained component. Am I right in thinking it was like pointing at a style sheet, but for a component?
Yes. And it was, you know, I think it was designed to be, as HTML was at the time and continues to be, obviously, you know, in the sort of declarative way, right? So just, and then tying behaviors to declarative statements, which, you know, the separation of concerns that evolved with like WASP and web standards movement and things like that probably would have taken this in a different direction anyway at that point. But yeah, absolutely. It was about kind of, I think it was very much about tying behaviors to markup, which is, you know, such a fundamental piece of the web. I mean, you can maybe argue that like when Backbone.js came out, like that's truly what it was trying to address. So it's just very interesting to see that there were, as you said, Jeremy, stops and starts to all of this as we continued through iterating on the ideas. So I think it's worth now turning to, you know, maybe this would be hard to understand for people that are just starting now, but, you know, talking a little bit about XML, which would lead us to XUL, which was kind of an outgrowth of that, which was an attempt at components in a different way at Mozilla. So, you know, the framing I would give, and you all have, I'm sure, lots of perspectives to bring to XML in general, but, you know, the perspective I would bring is that there was, you know, XML became pretty popular at the W3C, and there was an idea that HTML would evolve into a version of itself that embraced XML, with much stricter rules around how markup was formatted in an attempt to create, maybe 15 years too early, an Internet of Things in some way, where, you know, if the underlying document could be semantic enough, that machines could understand the markup as well as humans could. And then you could do all sorts of interesting things. This was eventually abandoned, but I, you know, that is what was in the air. And this is why I think XML became the next place where you see attempts at encapsulation and components happen. So yeah, let's talk about XUL and XUL and XML and kind of how those two things combined next, I would think.
Well, I remember, you know, first coming across XML in the late 90s, and it was in the Ascendant. And on the one hand, it was a formatting a format, I guess, you know, for structuring data. And it made sense to me. I could look at it and it would make sense. Like, oh, yeah, I get it. You can structure anything any way you want. On the other hand, it was also, it was a way of life. It was like, I remember it really did feel like, you know, have you let XML into your life yet? You know, it was our Lord and Savior, XML. It really seemed like it was, everything was going to be XML, which explains why, you know, well, let's turn HTML into XML. We're halfway there already with the ML part. Let's go the whole hog. But like everything, like if it, you know, if it could be XML, it was going to be XML. That was my memory, that it was not so much about the format, it was the culture. Brian, you remember this?
I 100% remember that. I think part of it comes out of the fact that, like, HTML has its origins in SGML, which had been around for like 30 years before that. And like, more or less, HTML just, like, a whole bunch of existing thousands and thousands of documents were readable in your browser already on the day that Tim made the browser. Like, if you knew how to find them, you could open them, because it worked with this forward compatible parsing and like partial understanding. So like you might only see some headings and paragraphs and that's all you can make sense of, and the rest you just don't pay attention to the tags, you just still display the text. And when HTML came along, it was itself not really SGML. Like SGML had like standards, like ISO standards. There were like many, many, many ISO standards groups. And there were these sort of like two competing formats, like SGML and EDI, kind of in terms of like trading data, right? You know, like the people who saw that saw the web taking off and they were like, hey, wait a minute, I'm glad you're on board, but let us, you know, clue you into all the things that you're missing. And so there was this opportunity to like loop in all the SGML people when they started W3C, and they did, and they thought, well, we could like sort of fix SGML, right? And make XML. And so the whole world of industry was behind that because it already had momentum on that side and now had this excitement momentum. And I think that like you said, Jeremy, it became like I don't know about a religion, but people have compared to like, you know, the high priests of XML or something, you know, like, but you had to do everything in XML. I'm surprised actually that, like, I think that if there was a world in a race that was slightly different, like even CSS would have been expressed in XML.
Well, they tried. That's accessible style sheets formatting objects. That was an attempt to make CSS in XML, and it was incredibly baroque, in both ways you can hear that word. Just imagine taking CSS rules, turning them into XML, but like really, really complicated XML. So it was tried, and pretty much everything, like Jeremy said, everything was going to be in XML.
You know, even though that reality didn't come to pass, everything being XML, I feel like maybe you can draw a bit of a line from, you know, that time period and today. Not so much with Shadow DOM, but with the other part of web components, which is custom elements. Like the X in XML was for extensible. And the idea was, okay, you want to extend HTML and come up with your own elements. And yes, there's, you know, okay, now what do they do? How do you give them behaviors and all this other stuff and encapsulate what's inside those new elements you just made up? But that idea, extensible markup, that's what we ended up getting, right, with custom elements. Yeah. It looks different because you got to have your dash and all of that, but it is there to solve that problem. It's like HTML doesn't have enough elements. I want to make my own elements. All right, here you go. It's not using XML. It's using custom elements, but, you know, tomato, tomato.
I mean, this is part of why Tim reasoned that the forward compatible parsing was a good idea too, right? Like people are going to want to make their own tags and you can't just stop parsing, right? So people in this sense were probably mainly still browsers when he was thinking about it, because, you know, there were like 35 browsers back then. Like it was a hobby thing that people would build. But he thought, you know, people are going to want to build their own elements, and then eventually some of them will get popular and copied, and there you go.
Yeah, I remember that promise of XHTML, actually, was that, oh, well, it will be extensible. We won't be limited to just the elements that are defined. And actually, if you, in the first edition of CSS, the Definitive Guide, some time is spent on why CSS will be important when you can invent your own elements. Not a lot of time, but a little. You know, because right around 1999, 2000, that was what was being sort of promised. And yeah, in custom elements, we can do that. So yeah, there were a lot of people who were really excited about, you know, oh, I can invent my own, you know, whatever element that will capture, you know, structures that HTML doesn't. We can have a poem element with stanza elements and whatever. And now, yes, we can do that now. And because CSS is, you know, sort of language agnostic in a sense, it will style any markup that you send, that you tell it to style. You know, we have that. So yeah, it's kind of cool to see that part of the promise come to pass.
And there was something else happening around this time, which I think really informs where Shadow DOM or Web Components goes next, which is that AOL purchases Netscape for a very large sum of money. And as part of that, they're actually starting to kind of abandon the browser game and moving it into an open source foundation, or what will eventually be an open source foundation known as Mozilla. And they start working on a browser called Firefox. And as they're working on kind of taking Navigator, what was Netscape Navigator, and transforming it into Firefox, they start to take a look at the underlying structure of the browser. And now XML is very available to them. And so what they develop is something that's called XUL, which is XML user interface. And they really use this as a way, you know, there's all these sorts of components that live outside, like in the Chrome of the browser, like outside of the web page itself, that they wanted to be able to develop using some sort of standards and in a way that was consistent across operating systems. And so that's where XUL starts to come from. And that's probably, as you were saying, Jeremy, like one of the first instances we can, you know, that we have of custom elements, like this idea that we're going to build custom elements with complete encapsulation. And this is actually, as a side note, like Brian and I started talking about XUL like 6 years ago, right? So it's like, it's also just something that, I've been interested in and just remains kind of underneath a lot of the work that I've done in looking into web components, but it's very, you know, it's a kind of a hidden API, or there's something that was really being developed by Mozilla specifically.
Just a fun little footnote that, you know, you said extensible user interface is, you know, but there's a cleverness in here that this is actually a reference to the movie Ghostbusters.
Yep.
And the XML namespace is mozilla.org/keymaster/gatekeeper/there.is.onlyzool.
Yeah, so XUL is pronounced Zool typically.
Yeah. So
am I right in remembering that this was proposed as the way you would make browser extensions? That like it was the language you'd build them in, or have I got that wrong?
No, they used it like they kind of dog-fooded their own thing. There's a bit of this that is part of why I made this observation early on, which is about like, what thing are you building out of? What's your mental model? And there was this idea at the time that like HTML is good. It was kind of cute for documents, you know, but it would be great if we had something like that for applications. And at the time, there was this big idea around like a portable virtual machine, one language you could run. And could we find a way to build something that was like applications with this XML described user interface and a virtual machine? That's where you get like Hot Java, And it's also where we spawn out these ideas. So Microsoft comes up with Zool and not with Zool, with XAML, and Silverlight is their engine. Yep. Flash has their own engine and they create Flex, and Mozilla creates Zool trying to keep it standard. So both, you know, Flash and Microsoft were betting they could, you know, own the second web, the application web, you know, and Mozilla wanted to do something in a standards body. So they did this thing. They tried to take the ideas that they saw that were being discussed with HTML components, the good ideas, the not so good ideas, learn something from it, and try to standardize Zool. So a lot of Firefox was actually built out of Zool components, like the toolbars, the menus, the all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Zool was for describing like visual components of a web. So the browser Chrome could be described in Zool. You could add a browser toolbar by describing it in Zool. So, I mean, that part of web components, yes. Or web, sorry, of that part of browser extensions, yes. You also needed XBL, I believe. Yeah, in order to change the behavior. So there was Zool and XBL, which didn't...
I think XBL was sort of an outgrowth of that, of Zool. And and then, as Brian said, Microsoft was trying something relatively similar with XML, at least as the backing, as XAML. I am curious, you know, from your all perspective, you know, what were the good ideas here? Like, what was interesting about XBL? What was interesting about XAML and Flex and all of that that would later inform, you know, some of the features that we have today?
I guess it's interesting that, you know, this has all been about encapsulation. Two things. Encapsulation, one. Extensibility, the other. Right? That's already come up, talking about XML in general. These are all XML-based things. So there's kind of this melding of extensibility and encapsulation that seems to be a thing people want. And it's interesting how you described it there, Brian. Like, all these companies are trying to be the ones who are going to win this battle for this combined extensibility and encapsulation. And then, I mean, maybe I remember the history wrong, but this would have been then around the time that a bunch of people at some browsers, like Opera, kind of took a look and said, wait a minute, HTML isn't dead, it's just resting. Like, we can revive it. And as far as I understood it, the idea wasn't to chase the dream of encapsulation and extensibility in its abstract form. It was, why don't we just give people what they mostly want? Like, people are crying out for video and audio and some more form controls and stuff like that. So what if we work on that? And I know things got very messy there for a while with the Watt Working Group and the W3C, but leaving all that aside, or we'd be here all day. I think the interesting thing was what became HTML5 was not about extensibility and encapsulation in an abstract way. It was about extensibility in a very targeted way. We're going to extend the input element. We're going to extend, you know, HTML. We're going to add some new elements. So I feel like maybe the narrative changed there as well. It was almost like, oh, we tried the infinite extensibility thing in the XML era. Look, we did Zool, we did XAML, we did all these things. It didn't work out. And then when we went for limited extensibility, let's us all agree on, you know, the 80% use case. Oh, that worked out well because we got HTML5 and that turned out to be a great success. So maybe there was almost like a bit of a detour there where like infinite extensibility just took a back seat for a while. Like, we tried it. It, you know, it was great in theory, not so good in practice. So It took a backseat until HTML, it felt like, got back to a stage where it's like, okay, it's time to start talking about infinite extensibility once again.
Yeah, I mean, the the split that happened in W3C was over, curiously enough, like what to do with compound documents and web applications. And there was a group that was working a lot on the extensibility and specifically like XForms was a big part of that. And you know, like the sense was there was a workshop and people presented different position papers and yeah, there was a sense that one argument was, look, making the web break the way that we're doing is like not helping anything. Maybe we can get to this amazing XML future. Maybe. Like, I'm not saying we can't, just maybe there isn't such a clean break between application and document. And maybe we can take sort of like the good parts of what we learned in those other things and put them into a more finite answer in HTML. And so they took a lot of the things from like XForms that seemed like good ideas and tried to bring them into HTML and to do it quickly by web standards, which I think meant about a decade. That's what it took.
Yeah. And my memory is that after that decade is when then we started to get the first murmurings of Shadow DOM. It was like,
that's correct. Yeah.
We sort of figured all that stuff out and got it to a good enough state. And it's like, all right, time to pick back up that thread. I don't know if, I don't know if anyone else remembers it like that, but maybe I'm applying it in hindsight.
No, that's pretty accurate. It is interesting though that Ian Hixon, who was the editor of HTML, also was sending things around about XBL because he was keen on what to do with XBL. Its charter expired. We had XBL 1, XBL 2, like neither of them was actually what Mozilla did. There were things that were problematic and like, what do we do about it? I don't know if Jay, you want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, there was essentially a 10-year reshuffling here, right? Which is funny because I think when you talk about web history, you often are talking around the gap that exists, you know, from, you know, 2002 or so to like 2010, you know, with the emergence of HTML5. And so I think that there's this reshuffling that happens. And so not much happens in, you know, XBL, as you're saying, is like continues to be developed. It's not like Silverlight's going away or anything. Like all of this still exists, but there's not a lot of forward progress until we get to, I want to say 2010, 2011, when this idea is now picked back up. And so a lot of it is an outgrowth of, you know, people thinking about this for a long time. So we are not starting from scratch when we are talking about Shadow DOM. We are starting from various starts and stops and implementations that we've discussed here. And now in 2010 or 2011, somewhere like that, you start to get conversations about how Shadow DOM can be structured. And I think a lot of that came from WebKit specifically early on. And it's going to get confusing again because we're going to have to talk about the first iteration of Shadow DOM and the second iteration of Shadow DOM, which are somewhat different. So don't worry, we still have plenty of confusion to wade through here. But it, you know, we did start to get what will eventually become what we're all familiar with as Shadow DOM. And so that's 2011 or so.
Would I be right in thinking this was around the time that we got a manifesto on this idea with the extensible web manifesto? Or did that come later? I can't remember when that was first published. But I mean, we're back to that word again, extensible.
It came through those discussions.
Yeah.
But it came a year or two later. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That makes it felt to me like what it was kind of saying was, okay, HTML5 was a great initiative for the 80% case, and we got good enough, and now it's time to tackle the 20%, and here's how we should do it, and we nail this manifesto to the church door. This is what we want to do, is we want to give developers access to the low-level APIs and browsers and let developers figure out what they want, and then we can come along later and standardize the good stuff that comes out of that, is my recollection of what the thinking was.
Yeah, that's pretty right. I think not just the low level, but medium levels. We talked about how all of these other sort of systems that you would build on have sort of multiple layers, and you can look at like an architectural diagram of them and layers, and you can sort of say at this level I want to build something on top of that layer. And you couldn't do that with the web, right? Like there were not a lot of things that you could plug into exceptionally low level or even something intermediate. The only thing that we had that was sort of like that was the DOM. And with just the DOM and some scripting, we had done so much. I mean, polyfills is, I think, how we found our way out of stagnance. Like we couldn't, we're at this like catch 22 where the world was 95% Internet Explorer 6. And that team had been dismissed to go work on Flash and Silverlight, or Silverlight and XAML.
Jay, you were saying that, like, there was these different levels of Shadowdom. Like, there was a level zero, and there was a little, you know, false starts, level ones, level two. But in my memory, the way I was sold the origins of Shadowdom was, this is what browsers were doing anyway. Like, the breakthrough came with DevTools. I may be misremembering, but the way it was always explained to me was, hey, did you know if you looked inside a select element, it's got its own little miniature DOM in there. And one of the browsers allowed you to do this, and DevTools, now all the browsers allow you to do this. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of how to explain that this Shadow DOM thing isn't being invented from scratch. It's always been there. Browsers have been doing this the whole time, but now we as developers will get access to that. Which, by the way, just this was a kind of naive response, but I always found that explanation a bit weird, to say like, oh, here's how we'll explain Shadow DOM is, look at the select element. Now look inside, it's got like its own little document inside the opening and closing tag. And it's like, the one thing I know of the select element, and most developers know, is it's a real pain in the ass to style a select element. So like, of all the things to try and sell me on a technology, it's like, you know how the select element's really hard to style? Now you'll be able to make things that are really hard to style too.
Oh boy.
Which was a naive response, but then also looking at the problems with Shadow DOM today, yeah, I wasn't a million miles off to say the styling issue is an issue.
Yeah, no, you were not being naive at all. I feel that you were exactly correct.
I think, Jay, this leads into a thing that you want to talk about what did we even mean by encapsulation, right?
Yeah, I think that what is interesting is that after having tried different things for over a decade or maybe 15 years or so, finally, I think when Shadow DOM is starting to be talked about in discussion threads, there is this moment where, you know, I think especially folks from Apple, I believe, were saying like, let's pause for a minute and just talk about what encapsulate, like, what do we actually mean by encapsulation, because that is going to be what everything else kind of flows from. So there's there's a discussion thread about that, about like, how do we define encapsulation? And then I think, Jeremy, what you're picking up on is then there is what grew out of that was a real attempt to like, we need to explain this to people, because if we're going to get this out there, people need to understand what is happening. Because it's maybe one of the more advanced things that's ever going to be, you know, introduced. It's not a new element, right? It's something almost entirely new.
And it makes sense to define encapsulation, because it can mean different things. Like, there's encapsulating styles, and that's a whole thing. Not having styles leak in or out of some boundary. And are we talking about styles? Are we talking about behavior? Do we want the same rules to apply when we're talking about, you know, behaviors, when we're talking about styles? So it makes a lot of sense to say, okay, you know, you keep using that word, I don't think it means what you think it means when it comes to encapsulation.
Yeah, so Maciej sent this email it's kind of famous email, Anna Van Kesteren wrote about on his blog a couple of times now. It's Wednesday, June 29th, 2011, and he lists five different kinds of encapsulation, actually. Encapsulation against accidental exposure, which is like, you don't want things just willy-nilly leaking out through whatever, so that they get easily screwed up, which is basically what we have, you know, friendly fire. I wrote a blog post about this called friendly fire. Then there's encapsulation against deliberate access. So no API being provided, which lets code outside the component poke at the internals, that the internals would choose what to expose. So that's like today we have like export parts, right? There's inverse encapsulation. There's isolation for security purposes. There's inverse isolation for security purposes. And so their original proposal, Google's original proposal, just had a thing called Shadow DOM. And it just had a shadow root. And that was it. That was more or less the whole trick, right? There wasn't more than that. If you include a script, it's just also in your document, there's no JavaScript encapsulation. There's no, there's not a lot that's special in here. You can walk across that boundary. Apple was really concerned that what they wanted was something like what the browser does. They want to be able to make a component and tell you what you can and can't style because they don't want anybody to break it. Right, like they don't want anybody to break it. The only way that they can guarantee that is if they control more or less everything about it. So this is where we get the closed shadow root. So now we have an open shadow root and a closed shadow root.
But I think the original definition hinged on that definition number two, which is encapsulation against deliberate access, right? Which is that closed shadow root idea, which is, I think, where level zero comes from and potentially where the divergences between what would eventually become the Shadow DOM we know today is and that first attempt. Does that feel like an accurate way of kind of framing that, Brian?
Yeah. There were some other things here too, but yeah, more or less there was this proposal for how you would project things into the Shadow DOM. It was kind of different in version 0 and version 1, but that being a kind of an important thing, right? Like if you want to be able to define something, is it just these islands or is it these sort of islands with holes in them that you can put things into? So that's a thing that's interesting about the Shadow DOM. Previous editions of the Shadow DOM also had like multiple shadow roots and very complex inheritance relationships where like you could customize something and then I could customize that thing. It's very complicated. And I think you could, in the original Shadow DOM, you could customize any element. So it's interesting, when we started these, there was this, even back in maybe 2010, there was this WhatWig page. It's still out there. Maybe we can link to it in the show notes. That was like components use cases. And I remember Ian Hickson only wanted to do the is syntax. So you'd be able to say like input is something. And then the idea was that you would then just get accessibility for free. And you can see in that component use cases, one of the ideas in there that he explained to me was, well, so like if you were installing an operating system back in 92 or something like that, you would have had some primitive select menu, right? Like, and you would just have your arrow keys and that's what you could do to set the time zone. They would just be like an alphabetical list and you would up down until you found it and that's it. But now today you have these like nice graphical map things and you can find your city from points, and you don't want your arrow keys to move up and down alphabetically. That would be like really, really strange if you like were like Pennsylvania, no, I want to go down because it's Virginia, but then you wind up in, you know, like Portugal or something, right? Like very strange geographic leaps. But the challenge with that was and is, this was actually Apple's eventual objection to supporting is at all, is that a select element is not a map, right? Like it, like I say, the keyboard interactions work differently. Like you have to provide new DOM, and as soon as you provide new DOM, you have to provide new behavior. Part of the reason I mentioned that, though, is that like some of those other things that predated this had different splits as well. And I think it kind of keys in on this like underlying thing that I stress a lot, which is like, we don't actually know what we're doing, right? Like we're trying a lot of things, and there's a like, wouldn't it be great if we just standardized this thing? And, you know, as soon as we start standardizing this thing, we also figure out something problematic with it or better or whatever. And so you can see these kind of interesting trees. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen those like diagrams where they diagram like the evolution of music or something like that. There are interesting evolutions of shadow DOM like ideas. I think in XAML, there is still a logical tree and a visual tree. And internally in the browser, there's also this kind of thing with the accessibility tree being kind of the logical tree and the visual tree and like how they're related.
So we're kind of, there's kind of different things here, right? Because the whole discussion around is and extending HTML, yeah, it is related to shadow DOM, but really that's more about custom elements. How do you do custom elements? Can you extend HTML? Do you have to make your own custom element? And then meanwhile, there's shadow DOM, which is about what happens inside that custom element, the encapsulation part. And I think it's good that those two things are separate, that you don't have to do one. Well, I guess you have to do a custom element in order to do a shadow DOM, I think. But you don't.
That's why I was bringing it up. Yeah. So this create a lot of tension and friction because, you know, how does that work? So you can create a div. You can go just get a div or a bunch of elements in HTML. You can get, I don't know, maybe 100 of them and just create a shadow DOM on them and no problem at all. But we can't let you do that on interactive elements. So you can't create a shadow DOM on interactive elements. So in that model, you do need to create a custom element and use composition rather than inheritance.
But I think it is good that they aren't too tightly coupled, these different technologies that all fall under this web components banner. You don't have to use all of them. It's maybe a bit confusing that, you know, when the definition of what is a web component is given, it's got all of the possible things listed, like templates and slots and shadow DOM and custom elements. And maybe that gives the impression that a web component is when you use all of those things. But I really, really like that it doesn't have to be that way. So, you know, Eric, when you wrote that blog post about using the light DOM, like, I'm totally going to use a custom element and I'm not going to touch the shadow DOM. And that got a lot of traction. That really resonated. I think the light bulb went off for a lot of people because they looked at shadow DOM or tried shadow DOM, like, oh, this is really not what I was hoping. Like, oh, it totally encapsulates things except when it doesn't, you know. It's there's so many edge cases.
Totally encapsulate things, including things I didn't want to be encapsulated.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The idea that you could just not use it, and that's a totally valid web component, just using custom elements, makes a lot of sense. Now, in other situations, you totally do want to use them. My friend Tris Mudford, he wrote a great blog post about writing a web component where he did need pretty much 100% encapsulation because it was going to be used like an embed. It was going to be used as in like, drop this into your website and it opens a little portal to our website. Like, you know, when you were embedding a tweet or a YouTube video, that kind of thing. And in that situation, you're going to want a much bigger level of control than me. You know, when I'm writing web components, I am both the author and the consumer usually. So like my use case is so straightforward. If I don't want to mess with shadow DOM, I don't have to. And also, it's interesting that, like, if I do come across a situation where I really want to scope these styles, I want to encapsulate some styles, Shadow DOM is one way to do that, but it's not the only way. And that's nice. You know, we've got multiple ways of scoping styles and not letting styles leak or letting styles leak, depending. And that, I think, choice is good. I'm happy with the situation as it is now.
I just wish it were easier to pierce that encapsulation layer when you need to. I ran into this just recently. I was using a web component that somebody else wrote to do one of those slidey comparison things for images, right? Where you have two images on top of each other, but as you slide, you reveal one, obscure the other, and vice versa. Given the way I was trying to use it, like, the actual divider with the drag part was not nearly visible enough. And I tried to customize it, and I eventually more or less gave up because they had exposed like 7 custom properties, and that was it. That was all you could do unless you could figure out how to modify. And I didn't, yes, if I dug into the guts of this thing, I could probably have figured out how to do what I wanted to do, but I didn't have time. Like, this was not the centerpiece of a thing I was doing. It was I need to put this thing out and it needs to have something like this. And I'm going to make it work as best I can.
See, that in itself is interesting, because I think if you're going to write a web component that you're then going to put out there for other people to use, I do think you need to approach it with the same level of responsibility as if you're a browser maker and you're about to mint a new HTML element. Like, maybe not quite that level of, you know, thinking through all of the possible implications with accessibility and internationalization and customization, all of those things. But it does kind of tie back. Like, the promise of web components was, hey, you'll be able to create new elements just like a web browser does or has been doing. But I feel like the counterpoint to that is, if you're going to do that and you're going to share these with other people, you need to think like as if you're making a web browser.
Yeah. And realize that more people than you are going, like, people are going to have use cases other than yours. You know, I'm not here to say that the person who wrote that web component was, you know, engaging in malpractice or whatever. It was frustrating because in the web inspector, if I dug into the Shadow DOM, which it will show me what's in the Shadow DOM, and I could see, like, this thing here is an SVG, like the arrows. If I could, you know, do this thing, or if I could style that SVG, okay, that would work. Like, I could put a background image and a border radius on the SVG that contains the two little arrows, and that would be enough. But I couldn't get through that layer enough to make that happen. So this is why, you know, when I write quote unquote web components, I'm not really writing web components. I'm writing custom elements because I want all of the guts to be accessible to anyone else who might use them, including future me, right? Like, 6 months from now, when I come back to the thing, whatever it is, I'm like, oh yeah, I need to modify this because of reason. Yeah. I want it all right there. I want the whole thing in the light DOM. I want all of the CSS to be able to apply. And yes, that does mean sometimes that there's the possibility that the page CSS will affect what's in the thing. But that, to me, that's okay because I put the thing in that page and it should be, you know, affected by the overall page. And if I want to not do that, then I just write some CSS to undo it. It's not a huge deal, as opposed to the veil of shadows prevents you from advancing. It's just, sorry, it frustrates me.
The other kind of friendly fire that they're trying to prevent isn't just CSS, though. It's like DOM selectors, where we want to attach events and
sure,
build new DOM. We select something, and it could very well select your guts in your component and respond to your events. And so
I'm glad that the Shadow DOM exists. I'm probably not going to use it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in the same place.
What's interesting is you know, web standards people and browser makers and everybody spent however long we've been talking over this chronological period, which is essentially 25 years, about encapsulation, which brought us to Shadow DOM, which brought us to the tools that we have today. And so I think that there's something interesting about the idea that Shadow DOM becomes the enduring principle by which we keep returning back to, right? Every 5 to 10 years, we return back to that idea in a new form. And now we have it. And it's in, you know, 2015, this starts to get implemented in browsers, and we have it, which then allows us to start thinking about all of these new problems in much more interesting ways. Like, how great is it that we, as, you know, web developers, can now have a nuanced conversation about how, what the level, the exact level of encapsulation that we want is such a gift, right? When you think about it in terms of the binary way that this usually kind of turns out.
Yeah. I mean, we've had them for 10 years and people are still, like me, complaining about the encapsulation level that was chosen.
But now we have options, right? Now we can do, well, maybe I'll use cascade layers. Maybe I'll use scope, you know.
True.
At least now we've got other ways of potentially solving our problem.
I mean, yeah, the encapsulation is, like you say, coming to CSS, or in some senses is already there. Like, CSS was completely not encapsulatable, really, within itself. And now you can encapsulate bits of CSS. From other bits of CSS, you can, we've had the Shadow DOM to encapsulate DOM and markup and CSS. But yeah, I feel like now, you know how you were saying, Jay, you were saying every 5 to 10 years, we would talk about wanting encapsulation. Now we have encapsulation. I think we're on the 10-year point where maybe it's time to talk about how can we make the encapsulation much more flexible? We have encapsulation, right? But how can we make it so that, as an example, is there a way that I can have a web component where I say the DOM is completely encapsulated, but the CSS is not?
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Or both or neither. As an example, like, is there a way that we could do that just simply, like, with, I don't know, attribute values or something? I'm open to suggestions from people who are way smarter than me and have spent lots of time thinking about the actual guts of web browsers. But, you know, I think it's time to talk about what kinds of encapsulation do we want, or do we want all of them? And thus, if we want all of them, all of the 5 types of encapsulation that Maciej described, how do we make those available to authors and developers?
The other cyclical thing I just wanted to briefly mention is that, as I remember, the idea of the Extensible Web Manifesto was, here, we give you the underlying guts of the browser. You go build, extend the web with these components. You can, here's Shadow DOM, here's custom elements, here's all the stuff. And then after a while, the good ones will come into the fold and become fully fledged native elements in browsers. I haven't seen that happen, except maybe we're starting to see things like, you know, CSS only carousels, which under the hood are actually, like, you know, there's little bits of Shadow DOM happening there, and that's what you're actually doing. So maybe the time period has come where you start to look around and go, okay, what's worked and what hasn't, and what's worked maybe does become, you know, honest to goodness HTML or CSS.
I think it's worth remembering too that, like, all these things are being tackled not exclusively. You know, there's lots of other things going on. They're getting fractions of people's time. They're getting fractions of budget. And so you end up inevitably having to draw a box around something and say, let's see if we can ship this part and then deal with the next part once it's shipped. And so, like, what's the reason I'm bringing that up is because you can look all the way back at proposals from like 2011, 2012, and they had like much more stuff in it that we still don't even have. But we have been getting them. Every few years, we, you know, figure out a little bit more. We get a little bit more. We get a little bit closer to those original ideas. And they're usually not the way that we kind of imagine them. They're usually, you know, tweaked and matured in ways that make sense with another 7, 8, 10 years to think about it. But, you know, all the way back then, they had, you know, like effectively declarative shadow DOM. Like you had how we're going to use the template element to create these things, and how you could maybe do it declaratively. And you know, now we have declarative shadow DOM, but it's, you know, the thing that we could ship, and it doesn't have, like, they had templating. They had a proposal for templating. They had a proposal for attaching bindings that was very much like HTC called behaviors. All of these things. And so, you know, currently there are, and there have been for several years now. So it's not like this is 5 years, so we're hitting this point. It's like this has been developing for 6-7 years. There's discussions about open stylable, which is like the thing that you're asking about. Is there a way to do this, and how would I do it? And a lot of that has to do with complexities around how do you include things that are local but point to something above? Do we use like ID refs? Do they have to use, we have to keep it making sense. Like, should they be part of the same module graph? What does it mean? Because like things that are part of the same module graph, like, are singleton, like they're one thing, but you could have mutable instances of those. So there's a lot of hard problems to work out there. And even when you think, this is the problem we're working on, you will find that there are 2, 3, 4 interpretations of that same problem that people understand it differently. On specifically on the open stylable, about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that, Greg Whitworth, myself, Justin Fagnani, and somebody else all worked in a document to describe what we meant by open stylable, and there were 4 different things. So yeah, like, you want to be able to do all of them, which means that, well, probably we'll solve these low level things first. So now we have like adopted style sheets. There's people working on CSS modules that you can include. Progress is slow, but steady.
And so maybe the lesson we can end with is that probably Shadow DOM will never be fully complete, as is true of the web itself. And it's been kind of like an extraordinary arc just to get here that spans all of web history. I think we were talking about the second browser ever made, so maybe not the first 5 minutes, but everything after that, all the way to today. So it's just one of these really revolutionary concepts. And it's just, yeah, I think we're going to see plenty more of that.
So thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for putting this together. And maybe we'll try this again sometime.
Yeah,
I think we should.
Yeah, I'm up for it.
Let us know what else you're interested in.
Yeah, we'll get some votes going on a thread or something and figure it all out. Cool.